if you take the growth alone in demographics by sort of 2050, you're going to add 2 billion more people that are all going to consume 3 barrels per person per year. And if you assume that they're going to increase their living standards, then that alone adds 50% to the energy, the entire energy system, and extra 2 billion people adds another 50% to the energy system. So I find it's always pretty ludicrous when you come up with sort of a bearish long-term oil demand picture. I think EVs budged needle at all. And as we're seeing, like, plug-in hybrids are actually starting to win. I don't swallow the long-term massive straight battery electric adoptions. And so, yeah, that's kind of where I'm at on the demand side.
Trader Ferg, how are you, my friend?
Good. Thank you for having me back on, Andy.
Thanks for coming on. You know, it's interesting. And I was telling you off camera, when I think of you, I think of just the energy markets. And I really cut my teeth in trading and investing in really the energy markets and oil specifically. And that was in 1992 or 1993. I bought my first oil stock. It was, I won't name drop it. I don't even think they're around anymore. But yeah, and I grew up in Alaska, which is highly, highly dependent on oil. And so it was a big part of the economy. So it's always a pleasure getting your perspective on that, or listening to you and getting your perspective on that. So let's start there. Let's start with oil. In 2025, where are we at? What are you thinking? And then what's your take on all of this drill, baby, drill, if you would, if that's going to have an impact?
Certainly. So this is something I wanted to dig into the most this year, like just my own portfolio, because I took a beating last year in a lot of my energy exposure, particularly my offshore exposure, which kind of I didn't see the getting beaten up badly on the card. So that's, I find I do my best work when I'm having to draw down and I really decide what I want to add to. So the for the oil markets, I think I like to kind of come at it from three angles. So there's, like to figure out, like, where's demand at, where's sort of global inventories, and where's supply. Kind of separate those two a little bit. And so with demand, I guess pretty consensus at this point now between the IEA, the EIA, they've all come around. IEA's recently revised up its numbers, and they're all on long-term sort of demand growth of about 1.3-1.4 million barrels a day increase, which is kind of like the long-term average growth in oil consumption or oil demand. And that's kind of important, because if you just rewind a few years, we had all the rhetoric that COVID was going to be some peak oil and we're going to be rolling over. And some guy kind of always bang on about is just how robust that growth in demand is over a long time periods of oil. And whenever you sort of deviate from that growth trajectory, you bounce back to it quite quickly. And so examples of this was like global financial crisis, obviously pretty big dust up around the world. That was only 2.5-3% decline year on year. If you take the COVID sort of the government lockdowns, that obviously all air travel, locking people in their homes, slamming the brakes on all sorts of industries, there was consensus it was going to knock oil demand by a third. It ended up being 8.5% year on year, and so that just shows just how robust it is. And so whenever hear really bearish outcomes for oil on the demand side, just pays to keep that in mind, how much it takes to bring it down. And also if it does come down, how stimulative that is, because a lot of that demand is in the developing world, and if that you do get cheaper oil, actually have a stimulative effect that they'll consume more, and that's why it also bounces back. And so taking COVID as an example, we were back at an all-time high within inside 3 years. And that's on the demand side. I see no problems there. I see a lot of it being driven by developing markets. The word I like, or the, sort of the way I like to phrase it a lot is, we also concentrate the IEA, especially on the sort of Western centric view in the in developed countries. We consume 12, 13 barrels per person per year. But there's only, depending what, how you sort of segment in, if you're just taking the OECD, it's only sort of 1.6 billion people. And we're not growing at all, whereas you've got the rest of the world. And they're going to add another 2 billion people when they're only consuming 3 barrels. And if you take the growth alone and demographics by sort of 2050, you're going to add 2 billion more people that are all going to consume 3 barrels per person per year. And if you assume that they're going to increase their living standards, then that alone adds 50% to the energy, the entire energy system, and extra 2 billion people adds another 50% to the energy system. So I find it's always pretty ludicrous when you come up with sort of a bearish long-term oil demand picture. I think EVs budge the needle at all. And as we're seeing, like plug-in hybrids are actually starting to win. I don't swallow the long-term massive straight battery electric adoptions. And so, yeah, that's kind of where I'm at on the demand side. I see that staying quite robust. Come to inventories, and they're sort of at the low end. Crazy, certainly lower than you'd have believed. If you sort of look at sort of statements like the EIA saying we're in a sort of an oil glut, and it's going to be sort of a massive oil glut moving forward. And then from there, you just got to break down where they see the supply coming. And the one that really sticks out, the vast majority of it is the shales. And when you sort of go through where they, to back up a bit, the shales have supplied essentially 95% all the additional oil demand last decade. And so we're actually in a point on supply where conventional is rolling over and shales kind of fill back. And that can't state how big a win that was. It was equivalent of finding an entire Saudi Arabia in oil, yeah, and another entire Saudi Arabia in gas. So just that really plugged that hole with conventional rolling over. And now we're kind of projecting that shale fracking is going to continue sort of plugging this growth hole moving forward. And it's already talking about, will it play? It's already stalled out. Like if you take out the EIA's adjustments, it's stalled out the last year minimum. And you can remove some more adjustments. You take it back to sort of the end of 23, really. There's been no growth out of US shales. And what's quite interesting, you can see it's getting a lot gassier. And see, it's one of my people asking, like, how do you actually track this? You can just bring up the reserve reports that a lot of the US trackers, they less like good one to look at. It's like Pioneers. Granted, it's now being acquired by Exxon. You can see that crude is rolling over while that gas is going up and their NGLs are going up, just showing that a lot of these maturing and they're not going to be producing the same growth that we've seen in the past. And this is really important because it's a mirror image of what happened back in the 70s and 80s in which
there's
a lot of sort of a lot of examples essentially of you're saying how productive everything can become when really it was you were just working through the top tier stuff, like essentially just high grading. And it makes so much sense when you frame it in that way now that we're talking about how great productivity gains have been in the likes of Permian. Well, the rig count's been dropping. And it's just logical as every additional rig gets pulled off, you're taking lower performing rigs first. And so your productivity keeps climbing. And it's not until we see that rig count start climbing again that we find out where the productivity actually is at, because then they see have to move on to more of the tier two. And you've seen this if you look into some of the headlines coming out of the oil majors, like in particular Chevron. They've obviously seen that they have conserved, that cutting back spending, that longer sort of they're dialing back a lot of their growth forecast, dialing back then, and they're just going to conserve their kind of tier one asset, because otherwise they know if they push it hard, they're just going to shorten the life of it. And so coming to your question of sort of Trump's drill baby drill, I don't think can move the needle at all. If anything, sure there's some, he can get some wins with sort of easing up the regulation side. But when I kind of look through everything he's doing, if he's to fill the SBR, that's actually quite a significant addition to demand. Like if you fill the SBR over, it was 2 years, that was an extra, it was 200,000 barrels per day added onto demand. And if you had to fill it over, if you fill it over 2 years, it's 400,000 barrels per day. And if you fill it over 2 years was 400, and 4 years, I think it was 400,000 barrels a day added demands. That is pretty significant, especially when, as I've just gone through, I don't think there's any drill baby drill 2.0 coming down the line. And the only place that is, that does have the sort of resource to do it is Argentina. And I wrote a post going through this because I find it kind of fascinating. A lot of their well productivity is a lot higher than even you've seen in even the most prolific wells in the US. And there just isn't the capital availability. Like they're largely doing out of cash flow. It's largely just their national oil companies. And even the likes of Exxon has actually sold their acreage there and moved to Guyana, which tells you how they kind of view the economics. This is some of this is just because it's still they haven't managed to remove all the sort of socialist sort of financial engineering that goes on, sort of holding oil prices down to keep inflation under control, removal sort of certain price caps and capital controls. But yeah, as an overall picture of it, I see demand strong, inventory's low, and I think the market's gonna come around to supply not showing up, the Saudi spare capacity getting worked through sort of towards the end of this year, and then gonna realize we actually have quite a tight market.
Yeah, I really couldn't agree with you more. What's two questions with the whole drill baby drill thesis is where are you going to drill?
Where is it?
Yeah, I mean, drill all you want, because correct me if I'm wrong, there's no major oil field that's been discovered in like, 30 years or 40 years? I think, well, since the North Sea, if I'm not mistaken. So, and that was, I want to say 1980. So drill. And then another thing that really just catches me is just how why isn't it higher? Because I see the same things off of you, and that's an opportunity. I see the same thing, the same supply issues, if you would, and it's not adding up where the price is currently. And I think that's just a market anomaly, if you would, which translates to opportunity, if you would, as a trader.
Yeah, I just have this, I have sort of a post that I haven't even, I just got the start to it. And it's like the, I forget which movie logo it starts with, but it's just the big, I don't remember which company it is, but it's just got the big no one cares as the the start of a movie. I'm forgetting which title it is, but it's just the fact that no one cares about anything that's going to matter in a big way more than a year out. Seems there's everyone is just sort of hangs the Mag 7, the S&P, or even crypto sort of over, like, why should I even care about that when this has been the sort of performance is looking in the rearview mirror, and you come and just get beaten up saying that this has to matter at some point. And I'm just maybe a broken record, but just go back to the numbers, go through it all, and like, yeah, this has been underinvested in, supply has been underinvested in, and it's going to be a price reaction. And these companies are going to make a lot of money at some point, and it's just patience and stomaching a lot of volatility on the way and spreading your bets. But I've been more mindful of having more diversity in the portfolio than having a sort of a correlation that goes to one on any. I've tried to put more sort of my recent positions being Chinese tech. I like how cheap that's got, valuations there. That just moves to a different beat than Andy, whereas in 2024 I thought a whole lot of it was just a great setup and that all just moved down together, and still love it all, but it's it's been a painful sort of half a year.
Yeah, that's typically how it is as a trader or investor, is you got to take the pain. I can always speak from my own experience. Just always early. So how do you evaluate, how do you evaluate a company that you're going to invest in, an oil company? What are you looking for?
So, yeah, I struggle with this because I follow a whole lot of people that are all super smart and they all love different angles on the oil basis. So you've got like people that love hanging out and sort of, the Canadian sort of oil producers, and there's some fantastic value there. I always thought it was outside my circle of competence. I wasn't smart enough to sort of spot where the big asymmetry was there. And so the way I've mainly come at oil has been through oil services. And this was just largely a result of my mentor. And it's the idea, if you kind of locked on to really bottom crawling companies that have just been beaten up. Quite a few of them have gone bankrupt. I even have sizable positions in two companies that have gone bankrupt twice. And they're just writing off so much debt. They're coming out with such strong balance sheets. And you inherently know they're cyclical. Kind of like every time they go bankrupt, their ability for anyone to compete with them just becomes so hard. Like any of the big drillers, I see at some points a merger between the likes of a Seadrill, a Noble, or maybe even a Valaris. And I think I did the math on it. There would have been that would culminate in over sort of 14 billion of bankruptcy related write down. And these are super asset heavy companies. Like a drill ship is going to cost you north of $1 billion. And so for a company to be carrying all these assets with no debt against them, and anyone that's to compete with them, not only do they have to come up with the debt, they've then got to deal with a shipbuilding industry that had faced a whole lot of bankruptcies from building these things last time around. So it's, for starters, it doesn't really exist. And then on top of that, to build them, they're going to ask for far larger deposits. There's going to be long lead times. And they've also got a like coverage across the whole shipbuilding industry at the moment. It's about forward coverage is about 3 years. And so before they can even get a slot in a yard, it's going to take 3 years. And then drill ship to build it, it's going to be 3 to 5 years as well. So you've just got this period where you can have monster earnings. And I really love that angle because I feel like I've got a fat margin of safety. I can see where this is going on a long enough time frame. But yeah, it's been a rough few months. Trade is just, no one really cares about what you see a few years out. Everyone's focused on the immediate future. And if anything, there's a lot of people shorting all of this stuff, which is kind of fascinating. I've never had so many shorts in my portfolio as I have now. If I look across the offshore drillers, uranium, even Chinese tech's got a lot of shorts in it. So I view it as just double check my conviction, and I know they might fuel on the fire when things turn.
Yeah. Okay. So about that, it's really interesting. So my viewers know, and everybody knows, I love your methodology of looking for companies that are coming out of bankruptcy. That's in my mind, and this is not a recommendation. Everything you just said, because that's when they have the strongest balance sheets because of debt. They no longer have any debt or very little debt because they were coming out of bankruptcy. So I love that play. That's number one. Number two is I think there's so much, what's the right word? It's so much carelessness and apathy, I think is the right word, to the oil market, which is typically a sign of a bottom. Because no one cares. That's tip. And now a bottom could be 12 months away, 6 months away, 18 months away. This stuff can go longer than we think. But that's typically the signs of a bottom. That's when you want to catch things. And you don't want to pick a bottom, but you do want to look at the psychology of things. So I strongly agree with you in that regard. I'm also, you brought up uranium. I am also seeing this in uranium because we had such a great run up and then things, the price didn't crash, but the equities crashed, if you would. And I see again, the same kind of attitude that nobody cares, which is great if you're looking to buy, but I don't want to put words in your mouth. What are your thoughts on uranium and the uranium market?
Yeah, it's just been frustrating, honestly. Like if I've got to look back at some of my work I did on uranium, and I really thought the utilities would have come to the party by now. So I've been like, put my hand up, I've been wrong on timing. It's a funny trade because you don't really have to worry about the demand showing up. Like it's literally here. Clear. It's this waiting game because everyone gets kind of caught up in the whole like, sort of AI is going to add this much demand, but that was never the thesis. The thesis is just you can add whatever 450 odd operational. There's another 60 under construction. You know how much demand that's going to provide, and that demand's coming down the pipeline. It's not going anywhere. They can't swap over thorium. They can't. It's a sub 10%. Cost of the actual yellow cake of running the reactor, and there's a sort of multi-billion dollar piece of equipment. I always joke it's kind of like pulling up a gas station in your new Ferrari and deciding not to fill it up because the price of gas has gone up. No, you dropped a million on your Ferrari. You're not worried about what the cost of gas is. It's almost irrelevant. Yeah. And so, but yeah, going on to what's actually happened is I was certainly in the camp of when I saw Kazatomprom sort of missing, they're going well under their subsoil agreements. It was pretty obvious that there's going to be a dirty big gap between supply and demand come 2030. I'd see it being at least a quarter, if not more. And I thought there was going to start to be some panic. I sort of phrased it as the game of musical chairs, and there was 10 utilities dancing around. There was, at the start, there was 8 chairs in the middle, and then because I had a problem, came and removed another chair or two, and I thought there was going to be a panic. And yet here we are another year on, and in 2023, against the replacement rate for utilities, would have been 180 million pounds a year. They contracted 158 million pounds, so what, 2/3. And then the big surprise was last year, they only contracted 105 million pounds, so literally half of what they need. And this is, for anyone that knows history of it, when the sort of bull market kicks off, the last time around, the utilities got contracting sort of 140%. And so it was well past their needs because they've got to restock their inventories that they've drawn down. And so with that in mind, it's just frustrating seeing this sort of the market not understand how tight this is. And then on top of this, you've got the spot market, which is just essentially run dry. It's the volumes moving are reasonably mean at this point. It's traded all the way down to even the 60s, which I never would have really seen coming. So it's been in the sort of a humbling experience and how much this stuff can all trade down. And on top of that, you've got, as I was talking before, you've got heavy shorts right across the board. Like you've got between all the producers, which is only a handful, most of them have got short interest between 10 and 20%. And that's pretty significant when you consider like the, cause you can do it on short percentage of float, where you can do it on days to cover. And I think something like Boss has got, I think it's nearly 3 weeks to cover on their current volume, which is, for me, it just looked like a big pool of petrol looking for a spark. I don't know what that spark's going to be. Got some friends smarter than myself that figures probably when they add the additional conversion, so that sort of releases the bottleneck, and then the utilities can start contracting, and that kicks it off. Yeah, I'm frustrated, but still remaining long. And I think this is the fact that this is drawn out this much. This probably means it's not going to be a more disorderly market once it gets going.
Yeah, I would agree. And that's typically what it is that if it's drawn out like it is, when it just doesn't make any sense, the longer it's drawn out, the faster the covering, the faster the spike up, if you would. So I would agree with you. I'm actually actively adding uranium, really, really good, well, that I think are good uranium companies. Everything really, juniors to mids to large, to my portfolio. I just see next to the oil market, I see that as the best value, really one of the best values out there. Let's talk a little bit about natural gas. I was talking to Rick Rule actually, probably 9 months ago, 6 to 9 months ago, and we thought that was going to be the play. And boy, was he right. And really natural gas really took off. And it's interesting if you analyze it, like compared relative to natural gas, relative to the oil markets and what the oil market's at, as well as the uranium markets, it's very similar. It just all came really, and it hasn't had a huge spike yet, but it had, we're in a stealth bull market, a pretty good stealth bull market in natural gas. What are your thoughts on natural gas? Are you playing it? And where do you think it's going to go?
Yeah, so I missed it in that I chose to play gas through high quality thermal coal.
Okay.
That correlation broke down in November. That was painful. I didn't get the I've always liked the high sort of like the Newcastle type thermal coal plays because you super cheap valuations, big dividends, and you get the kind of upside call on gas. But that hasn't really played out well because there's been a lot of sort of I guess, lower growth, like you're seeing with gas. It's obviously been, it was always going to happen with, it was going to be a cold winter at some point. Everyone that was having constant, like it was just warm winter after warm winter, that was always bound to, sort of, yeah, have a cold winter at some point. So that's been a real boon, obviously. And, I missed it by not having exposure. I thought there was more asymmetry in oil. And as of right now, that's been wrong. I wish I had a bit of gas exposure, and I wish probably lightened up on a little thermal coal. As for now, I don't think it's a great entry point now. I feel there's far more sort of asymmetry on oil or uranium. But yeah, if you caught the gas, been long at going into this one, it's been a fantastic trade.
Yeah, let's talk about a little bit about coal. What are your thoughts on coal? And actually, as I mentioned to you just right before this interview, is I had dropping a Matt Warder interview that's dropping, I think, in the next 30 minutes. Just, yeah, what are your thoughts on coal going into 25?
Yeah, well, you should go and listen to Matt Warder.
Both of us.
Ignore what I have to say, because yeah, he is the expert. Him and Joe know more about coal than they've done more about coal than I've learned. But yeah, my take on coal here is I still like the long term outlook. I'm just needing to do more work. People I met being surprised by some of the numbers coming out of Mongolia, so I want to sort of do that justice and dig through that in a lot more detail. But they fully ramp up and get this railway going, what that could do. I still like some of the higher quality players. If you're talking about the market just not caring, I love players like kind of like Warrior, where Blue Creek out 2026, and when everyone's focused on what Farcoin's doing tomorrow, like no one's really caring about sort of an asset bringing on that much more production than talking about buybacks. I don't see how that's not accretive. I probably slightly more bullish on the thermal side here. I just think there's been, we've had a period of quite slow economic growth. It feels to me like coal particularly will catch it. So at the moment, even seen in Asia, it's been what's helped Europe with on LNG, is a lot of the LNG cargo for Asia has been rerouted to Europe, just on essentially lower demand. And yeah, I can see what's going to surprise a lot of people is everyone was kind of braced for Trump's tariffs to really the massive break on global growth. And what's been interesting is how he's treated very carefully around China. Everyone was kind of expecting him to come out throwing tariffs around, and he's been quite quiet on it. And if anything, it looks like they're just going to do some deals. And then that's another reason to be kind of either want to be long China, or I don't want to be short anything that China's competing with. And that's been another takeaway in the portfolio. Is I want to fade the Chinese. Is even just here where I live in Indonesia, I'm just seeing the likes of BYD. We went for a road trip for 2 weeks ago, Valentine's Day, and just sitting in traffic, I hadn't seen a BYD car here until 6 months ago, and I saw maybe like 20 to 30 in a row, and I was just like, it's,
yeah,
once you start, yeah, seeing that trend, you're like, they're really dominating. And I just see coal back to thermal. I just see that is exactly the same trend as I touched on with oil, and that it's a set developing market growth is tied to the hip with sort of coal demand. And this is a lot of it's unsexy stuff, like people adding aircon at night, just energy hungry, just increasing their standard of living. I think the coal trade, probably people's expectations got the skis slightly, mine included, with how sort of vertical things went. The Russian invasion. So I was on the coal trade for sort of the longer term outlook, and there's nothing quite like having a multi-bagger on your hand super quick when at a long-term outlook.
Yeah.
A lot of it's back to that slow grinding demand and underinvestment on the supply side.
Right. Anything you want to leave our viewers and listeners with? Just thoughts going into 25 as 25 progresses.
I've just seen a lot of setups. Just look, they really want to run once they can get some capital. I just feel like the whole NVIDIA and Mag 7 has just kind of claimed all the capital, and there's just so much that will flow to the right place. Maybe it's once we get a proper inflation scare, as the moment we're kind of in this twilight zone where all this money's been earned on AI capex, and there's really questions about where's the return going to be on all the spending. Like if the Chinese company can just integrate the likes of DeepSeek in their software, like, and it's all kind of this, it's all obviously DeepSeek's free. Like, where's the return going to be on all these billions of dollars spent on AI capex? And they're just forecasting. I was just looking at OpenAI. They're just forecasting, it's a chart that just goes up. Forget what that, it was added in the session of $5 billion every year in spending, AI capex, and all just sort of burning money. It was almost like the sort of unprofitable tech playbook, like even SoftBank's involved, which probably tells you all you need to know once he's sort of lighting billions on fire with it as well. I don't understand how any of this makes sense. And maybe it's inflation coming back that refocuses everyone to actually having to focus on cash flow. The old story, you can focus on growth stocks if there's no inflation, because you can wait for the, you can go with long duration stuff. But if inflation's ripping at sort of double digits, and you've got a question, and to protect your purchasing power, you keep out in front of that inflation. I feel like maybe that's what's oil, obviously oil will drive inflation, but it feels to me like it's probably going to be that sort of turns this whole ship and gets people focusing on sort of hard assets again. Because at the moment, feels like we're back in the phase similar to sort of 2020, when it was just tech and crypto and about any sort of hard fundamental cases.
I would agree. Well, Trader Ferg, I'm a really big fan of your work. How did people find you? Where do they go? And tell us about your Substack and all of that.
Just my Substack. I don't use Twitter anymore, or X, I guess, I suppose. Just Substack's where I sort of really just write about my portfolio. Essentially, I write about what I'm buying and what I'm thinking about buying, and sort of questioning where I might be wrong. I send out a free weekly email. That's the best article I've read, best podcast I've listened to, best quote up, and something I'm pondering about. And that's about it. And that's just Trader Substack.com. That's pretty much all my work is there.
Excellent. Well, I will link to that in the show notes below. I just want to thank you so much for your time. We are, I want to say, 13 hours apart. You're at the other side of the world from me. It's pretty awesome. So I want to thank you so much for your time. And again, I'd like to have you on again in the next 6 months or so, see where we're at.
Always happy to come on, Andy.
All right. Thank you.